It's an amazing thing that we're witnessing at the Capitol. We're going to build on that by convening this session of the People's Legislature and keep working toward getting the Capitol back to the point where we can have the voices of ordinary citizens heard there every day.
Because we have to take care of our disabled. We have to take care of our seniors. We have to take care of our teachers. We have to take care of our kids. We have to take care of one another. Because what we have in commitment and love for one another is what they treat as weakness. I don't see it as weakness at all. I see it as a commitment to public service.
This bill is not about balancing the budget. This bill isn't even about getting rid of collective bargaining. This bill is about eviscerating public sector unions in the United States of America, and it is wrong. This is a governor who has stated out loud that it was okay for him to consider bringing thugs into the rallies at the Capitol. To think of an incumbent governor sworn to uphold the law of the state of Wisconsin doing something, considering doing something to advocate violence is just, I think, obscene. I think it's impeachable.
It's absolutely true that you have established here some kind of bedrock from which all of this sprang. And our mission, I think, in the national media is to try to bring back the word and bring back some of the models that you have built up of both independent media and people coming together, meeting face to face, hand to hand. Nothing replaces that. You really set up a situation here where the first big worst mistake Scott Walker made was to pick this fight in Madison.
We have seen Democrats, often people who are so very disappointing, de-link from the compromises of the National Democratic Party and link in to the demands of the people of Wisconsin, to the progressive grassroots of this state, and become something that the founders intended, our elected representatives. And they have been absolute heroes in this struggle. One of the most lost stories of that assembly vote the other day, one of the most lost stories, was the fact that four Republicans crossed over and voted with the Democrats in opposition to this bill. Rural Republicans, some elected with Tea Party support, new legislators, not just old-timers, voted on our side of this struggle. These four Republicans that voted with us did so at incredible risk. They had all taken calls personally from the governor. They had all been pressured by the David Kochs, by all of the national power, and they broke to stand with us. This is very important to remember as you go back and talk to your friends. We now have bipartisan opposition to this bill. We have bipartisan opposition to this bill.
Please welcome the Executive Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, the champion of campaign finance reform, Mike McCabe.
Thank you all for coming. Anybody who was up at the Capitol yesterday, all of our jaws just dropped at what we saw. And, you know, somebody walked up to me and said, this is history in the making. And this fight is a long way from being over, but history's already been made. These are the largest and most sustained protests, the biggest demonstrations this state has ever seen. This is the biggest outpouring of citizen protest at that state capitol building in the proud history of our state. So history's in the making, but history's already been made. And you know, I heard from more than a few news reporters and a few others saying this place is starting to smell a little like a locker room. Now, I've been in my share of locker rooms and it hasn't gotten close yet. But all I'll say is this is what democracy smells like. One of the great blessings of what we've been through here this last week and a half or so is that some things have come into sharper focus. We've learned a lot and figured out what really motivates some people and what really is underneath what's going on. Some things have come into sharper focus. Well, for starters, we now know that our governor has a Coke habit. And I don't have to talk a lot more about the call. Peg Lautenschlager said a lot of things about that call that I, of course, agree with, but I don't need to say what she already said so well. Ed said some other things about the call that, of course, don't need repeating either. And I assume most all of you have heard the call or read a transcript, an amazing gift that was given to all of us because it gave us such insight into what is really behind all of what we're being put through. But, you know, for me, one of the things that jumped out at me was toward the end of that phone conversation when the person Scott Walker thought was David Koch said to him, you know, after you're done crushing these bastards, I'll fly out to California and show you a good time. And our governor did not say, you know, now that would be unethical. He said that would be outstanding. Governor, that would also be illegal. Because Koch Industries is a registered lobbying agent in the state of Wisconsin, and it's against Wisconsin law for a registered lobbying agent to offer such a perk, give such a perk to an elected official in this state. So it wouldn't be outstanding, it would be unlawful. And then, of course, at the very, very end, when they were bidding each other goodbye, I couldn't help but notice that Scott Walker said, thanks a million. And you know, as somebody who tracks the money in state politics for a living, I can tell you it was almost exactly a million. $43,000 from Koch's PAC directly to Scott Walker, which makes the Koch brothers right there at the top of the list of Scott Walker's biggest campaign contributors. It puts them right there at the top. But that wasn't enough. It wasn't enough for them to be among the biggest donors to Scott Walker. They then went and took $1 million and gave it to the Republican Governors Association, which spent a total of about $5 million getting Scott Walker elected. $1 million plus $43,000. That's just about $1 million. Thanks a million. So some things came into sharper focus about our governor. But things also came into sharper focus about the second branch of government. As we've watched our legislature carry on these past days. And I can tell you, we're having a people's legislature here today because what we have at the Capitol right now, the people who are in charge in that building, are really a legislature of ventriloquist dummies. What we've found, what we've discovered about those legislative leaders is they've got a speech impediment. You can see their lips moving, but what's coming out is really Scott Walker's voice. And if it's not Walker's voice, what it really is it's the it, it what it what is coming out of those lips is really money throwing its voice at the state capitol. And that is what we are seeing day after day after day after day is money throwing its voice in that building. And so we've learned an awful lot about the second branch of our government. We have also, and I am so glad John Nichols brought up April 5th, because we've also learned something pretty important about the third branch of government. And what we know now is that David Prosser has a Scott Walker problem. David Prosser has said, his campaign has said, that he will serve as a complement to Scott Walker and the legislative majority. Now, in this country, we have had a long tradition of separation of powers. This democracy is based on the notion that we have checks and balances, and among the most important checks and balances are a judicial branch that serves, not as a partner, not as a teammate of the legislative and executive branches of our government, but a check on that power, a check on that authority. It is supposed to be an independent branch of our government, and we have a sitting Supreme Court justice who says, as a matter of his campaign pitch, he says he will serve as a complement to Walker and the legislative majority. That's something that we've learned. We also know that already, and they're just getting warmed up, but already through the primary, Club for Growth put $321,000 into TV ads in support of David Prosser. It is the same Club for Growth that was on the air with radio ads before Walker's bill was even in the hands of state legislators. Club for Growth knew what was going on and knew what was about to be unveiled in the legislature before legislators did. And they were on the air with radio ads promoting this union-busting bill, and legislators hadn't been able to read it yet. And Club for Growth was then tipped off about the public hearing. That's something that we discovered and outed. They were tipped off and had been able to arrange bus transportation to the hearing, and then those who came on the bus, and there weren't very many, by the way, they didn't fill their buses, but the people who did come were ushered in a back door of the hearing room, and there were reserved seats for there, while ordinary citizens stood out for hours in lines and in spillover rooms. They were given that special treatment at that public hearing, and that is the same Club for Growth that has already spent over $300,000 in ads in support of Prosser, and we'll have a lot more to bring to bear before April 5th comes. And so what we know is that David Prosser has a Club for Growth problem and a Scott Walker problem. But what I think is so much more important to think about is the fact that David Prosser approved rules written by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and the Wisconsin Realtors Association, two of the biggest supporters of Scott Walker. He approved rules written by those two lobbying groups that say that judges can rule on any case involving even their biggest campaign supporters. That is what Justice Prosser has done. Now, we are in what I would describe as the third stage of ownership in our society. When you think back over the long history of our nation, we are in what I would call the third stage of ownership. And at every stage, there have been judges who have done the bidding of the ruling class. In the first stage, ownership took the form of slavery, and it took the form of institutionalized disenfranchisement. People forget that at the very beginning of our country, the electorate was 10% of the population. You had to be a white male property owner in order to have access to the vote. And yes, there was slavery. And decades and indeed generations of struggle ultimately were necessary to tear apart that first stage of ownership. But there were judges right there at that very beginning doing the bidding of the ruling class and protecting that design that was created. And of course, the U.S. Supreme Court, famously, in the Dred Scott decision, ruled that people can be property. So it was judges right there standing with the ruling class doing their bidding. Of course, the abolitionists ultimately won, and the suffragettes ultimately won, and that first stage of ownership, that design, was ripped to shreds. That did not mean that the ruling class was about to surrender control and relinquish power. No, they created a second stage of ownership. In place of slavery, in place of institutionalized disenfranchisement, they put Jim Crow, and they put poll taxes and literacy tests. They created that structure of segregation and institutionalized voter suppression. Okay, they got the vote, but we can make it damn difficult for them to exercise that right. And that was the second stage of ownership. And again, there were judges right there at the ready to do the bidding of the ruling class and protect that design. And of course, In Plessy versus Ferguson, the United States Supreme Court ruled that separate can be equal, creating a legal foundation upon which that despicable house could stand that they had constructed. Now, after decades and generations of struggle, ultimately the second stage of ownership was ripped to shreds as well. And, of course, the 1960s civil rights legislation, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, the Equal Pay Act, all of those great pieces of legislation ultimately undermined and destroyed that design, that second stage of ownership, which, of course, left us at a point where the ruling class had to think, okay, what next? Well, they were not about to surrender control. They were not about to relinquish power. And so they have created what I think is the third stage of ownership that we now confront, that we now have to rip to shreds. And the thing about the beauty, the evil beauty of this design is that it looks so much more innocent, so much more benign than the previous two stages of ownership, the tools of control, the mechanisms that were used to keep people in their place. Think about what the Koch brothers did. They put in $1 million to get Scott Walker elected governor. Well, it almost seems philanthropic when they're described as donations. What the ruling class has constructed, a third stage of ownership, is really something that is the construction of a political marketplace where participation is prohibitively expensive for all but a very few. That is the third stage of ownership. And again, judges were there at the ready to make sure that what they were designing had the imprimatur of the judicial branch. And in 1976, and it is no coincidence that it happened in 1976, on the heels of the civil rights legislation, which culminated, in my view, with the enactment of Title IX in 1972 or 1973, it was in 1976 that the United States Supreme Court ruled in a case called Buckley versus Valeo that money is speech. That was the beginning of the third stage of ownership in our society. And what we saw about roughly a year ago, just over a year ago, we saw that third stage of ownership come into full flower when the United States Supreme Court in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission said that corporations and other interest groups can spend unlimited amounts of money. Corporations are people, money is speech, and therefore no limit can be placed on what those wealthy interests are able to spend to influence our elections. That was the third stage of ownership coming into full flower. And that is very much what is at stake as we protest at the Capitol, because what we have before us is not only the challenge of confronting union busting and exposing what they're trying to do to Medicaid, and exposing what they're trying to do, allowing the governor to single-handedly go off and sell off state power plants without competitive bidding. A sweetheart deal in the making if I've ever seen one. There is so much ugliness in that budget, but at its core, underneath all of what's being done, is that third stage of ownership. And we have it as our challenge to, yes, confront and expose the union busting and confront and expose what they're trying to do about health care for the very most vulnerable people in our society. We have that as a challenge, but we also have it as our challenge to rip to shreds that design that they have put in place. And if we do not do that, if we do not succeed in this battle, we are going to simply see more of what they have handed us. And you know what has happened over the course of the last 30 years is we've watched jobs shipped overseas, and we've watched more and more tax breaks for the wealthy and more cuts for everybody else. And we now can say that 12,000 people in this country earned more in the last decade than another 20 million Americans combined. 12,000 people make more than 20 million. And we know that over the course of the last 30 years, the gap between the richest 1% in our society and everybody else has tripled. Now, where I come from, what they have done is they have just dug us a deeper and deeper hole. The jobs vanish, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, the middle class increasingly disappears. We have seen them dig us a hole that is deeper and deeper and deeper. And where I come from, if you've dug yourself a hole, at some point you just got to stop digging. And what have they told us? What has Scott Walker and what has his allies in the legislature told us? They said, you got to keep shoveling. We got to have more tax breaks for corporations. We got to have more cuts for health care for the poor. And we got to take away more school aid. And we got to, oh, by the way, more tax cuts for the rich and for the corporations. You got to keep on shoveling. Well, where the hell has been a president who stands up and challenges that digging? And where the hell has been a Congress? Where is the Congress standing up and saying, we will not dig that hole no more? Where is a candidate for governor who will say, we ain't going to dig your hole no more? If we don't have those voices in Washington and Madison, then we got to come in places like this and we got to decide that we're going to say that we're going to stand up and we're going to take 100,000 people to the Capitol. And what we are effectively going to say is, we ain't going to dig your hole no more. We ain't going to dig this hole no more. Thank you.
Wow. Mike McCabe.
I hope we go on from here with a good deal of education. This is, Ed, this is the missing component. We've gotten people out into the streets, but we saw this in the 60s as we grew with tremendous numbers, particularly in the period from 1967 through 1968. We were missing the education component. We weren't driving deep enough to keep a long and sustained commitment. We have to do more than march around the square. We have to make sure we understand our labor history, our collective bargaining history, and we coalesce around those two values we all share. And those are fairness and trust. Thanks.